You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date is August 31st, 2025. And one of the things I'm known for here is bringing out obscure nationalist or royalist or religious figures that have been either forgotten or just are not understood, considered obscure in the mainstream Western world, and bring them to light. I've done it now with dozens of men, and today we're going to do it with Igor Andrushkevich, who died in 2021. He was a fairly complicated character as far as his political ideology was concerned. We can't get it all done in one day, or in one lecture here. But he was a well-educated man. He was born in 1927. He was baptized in the Russian Orthodox Church abroad. He had military training from the Grand Duke Konstantinovich Cadet Corps and Bela Serkov. And he emigrated to Argentina in 1948. Argentina, of course, being a white country. Don't forget that. For the most part, it was a first world white country straight up until the Falkland Islands. And he became a editor of some major publications. The newspaper Frente Común, or I think it means the Common Front, in the 1950s. And it's interesting because he worked in metallurgical plants, both on the floor and as a financial and administrative director, which seems to be a good thing to do. He actually, you know, was at least for some time a worker. He was part of the Argentine and Paraguayan diocese of the Russian Orthodox Church abroad, and worked as a very fairly closely with Archbishop Leonti of Buenos Aires. He also published the monarchist weekly journal Nuestra Strana. He didn't create it, but he was a big part of it. But given his, I remember in 1927, he wasn't born in the old system. He was born after the revolution. But because of where he was sought after to teach Russian history and political science with the organization of Russian young intelligence officers of Buenos Aires. So there was apparently enough there to have a school for young intelligence officers in that one place. And he regularly gave reports and lectures there on everything that was going on at the time. Now, at some point, the Paris and Visa where he was went into schism. I don't know what that means exactly, in 2007. So he went to the Resurrection Cathedral. Then he was chairman of the Association of Cadets and Russian Cadet Corps in Argentina. And his main work, which we're going to be talking about quite a bit, macro politics, the theory of politics. He considered himself a sociologist, talking about the state, political ideologies and doctrines, and then the best state. It was never published, but of course, it has made its way through royalist circles. And he, 1995, he resumed publication in Buenos Aires in the quarterly newsletter, the Cadet Letter. Since 1998, he published the Russian Notebooks, an independent journal of Russian political thought. And he did, you know, Russian, Spanish, and English. He did the Spanish Perspectives, which is another one. Then the Cadet Roll Call was another one. So some of these were specialized. Some of these were more general. In January of 2009, he was part of the local council of the Russian Orthodox Church. The delegate from the Lady in the South American Diocese. And on August 23rd, 2010, Archbishop Mark Golokov awarded him the Order of the Blessed Prince Daniel of Moscow, Third Degree, in recognition of his efforts to strengthen church unity. Since 2010, he's published the Church Bulletin, which is a lot more than your typical church bulletin. It was called Under the Southern Cross. So it was a serious journal, not just a bulletin in the sense we normally use the word. He died of kidney failure in 2021 at the age of 94. So he had a long and great life, and unfortunately has gone into obscurity. He's extremely interesting. He spoke many languages. He was never quite an academic. But his experience and his natural gifts brought him very close to that. He was a public intellectual. So let me start here. One way to understand him, you know, the first steps to take. He believes in significant separate civilizations, all having their own distinctive, specific characteristics. And of course, one of those civilizations is a Western one. And at least since the Enlightenment, it's been based on some variant of rationalism, reason being autonomous in relation specifically to Christian religious beliefs. Now, historians like Arnold Toynbee held that the Western European idea, as well as the Russian Orthodox civilization, they both come from the same spot, that same Greco-Roman civilizational core. So in other words, they're twins in a way. But rationalism, the way we understand it, is not inherent in Eastern European life in the same way as it is in the West, where it came to dominate entirely. The Western European idea developed this characteristic as one of its central tenets. So he starts off by asking two questions. How does the attitude towards rationalism differ, and what place does it occupy in these two civilizations, meaning Eastern and Western Europe? Number two, how did this process of divergence occur, and at what stage of this process did Western European civilization acquire distinctive characteristics that did not fully coincide with the characteristics of Orthodoxy? Well, those two questions, of course, are things that we deal with here almost every week. And he answers that question in a million different ways, but the answer to the first is that the Eastern European Orthodox world has retained, more or less, the position of the ancient Greek culture that preceded it, while the West has largely abandoned it. The great historian of Russian philosophy, the archpriest Vasily Zankovsky, he summarizes it this way. This comes from his Fundamentals of Christian Philosophy in 1960. Ancient philosophy itself, as has been shown many times, is at the same time a kind of theology. Of course, in accordance with the religious consciousness of antiquity, the idea of pure philosophy is, after all, a favorite fiction of modern thinkers, who often transfer this fiction to the ancient world. The idea of a pure philosophy is generally an invention, a creation of thinkers of the Christian era, or at least the post-Christian era. This happened in the West, and the Christian East is not guilty of this tragic and ambiguous fact, one way or the other. And here, you mean here in the East, pure theology was not separated from scientific or philosophical thought, Everything was composed differently in the West. Currents and tendencies internally alien to Christianity gathered under the dome of the church. In other words, one tried to integrate itself with the science of its day, while the other one separated itself from the science of its day. Now, the second question, of course, is something that I know many of my listeners are very, very interested in. I've spoken about it on this show 9 trillion times. We're talking about the process of the Western world's departure from its origins, and hence its divergence from orthodoxy. And, you know, again, I can only give a very thumbnail sketch here, but this is basically Andrew Shkevich's schema. He starts off with essentially in 391 AD. You know, they shared a certain period of common life. But when the ancient pagan, when the Pope took the title Pontificus Maximus, remember that was right after the Eastern Roman Emperor Theodosius the Great had renounced that very same pagan title, incompatible with the title of a Christian king. And from that moment to 800, where the Roman Pope could create the Frankish king, Charlemagne, on his own authority. It's a long period of time, but ideologically speaking, this was this first rumbling. The split of Western Europe from, essentially from the ancient idea of the Roman Empire was followed almost 3 centuries later. And you know, I'm going to talk about the schism of 1054. 1054 was not all that interesting. People like to have a single date. Keep in mind that that wasn't meant to be a excommunication of anyone else. The churches were in communion outside of Constantinople with Rome for a long time afterwards. So 1054 is, you know, anywhere from 1054 to 1204 at the very, very, very latest. You had some connection, legitimate connection with old Rome. But that split initially didn't penetrate the mass of believers and really wasn't noticed by anybody. The disengagement had occurred before and then just increased afterwards, but it was still a very slow-moving matter. The idea is the departure of the Western Church, the Roman Church in Western Europe, from the conciliar agreement with the other churches, whose patriarchal sees were originally located on the territory of the East Roman Empire, as well as on the nature of the justification for that departure, especially the latter, indicate a massive contradiction that lies at the very basis of all justifications for it. This is your first aspect of rationalism that eventually would take over and eventually destroy Western civilization. It's hard to speak. It's difficult to speak bad of Western civilization. You know, I think of Western civilization, I think of the Gothic era. I think of Plato and Aristotle. I think of the greatness of these eras. So when I talk about Western civilization, I'm talking about the people who took it over. The slow but sure, and the people acting here didn't realize what they were doing. They didn't realize how bad this was going to become centuries later, and you can't really blame them for it. But the rationality of the Western conjectures and doctrines starts too, don't forget, with the donation of Constantine. Now, the donation of Constantine, which separated the Roman Pope from any other bishop, the donation always mystified me, because even if it were true, I'm not sure what it would prove. Because it implies that papal claims are derived from the decrees of the Roman emperors in Constantinople. They certainly didn't have an evangelical origin. And of course, so much of this was exaggerated or completely falsified. The text itself comes from the 5th century Acts of Pope St. Sylvester, who was a great man. The tale talks of Pope St. Sylvester's rescue of the Romans from a, quote, dragon, which could mean many, many things, and the pontiff's cure of the emperor's leprosy through being baptized. So dragon slayer can actually be literal. It doesn't have to be, though. By the 8th century, Sylvester and his apostolic successors were rewarded in the donation of Constantine with temporal powers, never, in fact, exercised by the historical bishops of Rome under Constantine. So this pseudo-Constantine determined to bestow on the seat of Peter, quote, power and dignity, glory, vigor, and imperial honor and supremacy, as well over the four principal sees, Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem, and Constantinople, and also over all the churches of God in the whole earth. So maintain the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul, landed estates in Judea, Greece, Asia, Thrace, Africa, Italy, and the various islands. The imperial insignia was donated because of this. The tiara. Now, even that has a, you know, this the Simeachian forgeries are another origin here. Pope Simeachus, who died in 514. It's a lot of the same stuff, a lot of the same cycle that produced the Liber Pontificalis. The context of the conflict between partisans of Simeachus and the anti-pope Laurentius. Also, this was to further papal pretensions, independence specifically, of the bishops of Rome from criticism or judgment from any ecclesiastical tribunal, putting them above everything, clerical and secular law. That's what these documents were meant to do. So, when these were exposed as frauds, I mean, the post-Nikon bishops in Russia would occasionally make reference to them, to buttress their power. It wasn't very common, but this was everywhere. And keep in mind that if this had any authority at all, it shows you just how powerful and what a religious figure the emperor was. The church was never meant to be an independent factor. Anyway, the primary case of the Western European ideology already contains a contradiction. Because this isn't very rational. This is, it's based on a fraud. And then, the excommunication of Constantinople in 1054. Remember, the 1054 contains accusations against the Eastern churches that don't make a whole lot of sense. And they're quite frivolous. It was pointed only at Michael Hilarius, and no one else. The Patriarch of Constantinople was not a blanket condemnation of anyone else. But the official reasons listed on the bull were simony. Well, unfortunately, every church in the universe has had that problem. That's very hard to get rid of. Showing its contempt for Roman Catholics by rebaptizing them. Allowing priests to marry, which is a little odd, because Roman priests were married too. Removing the filioque from the creed. The persecution of Roman Catholics in their domains, and ultimately disregard for the Roman supremacy. So all of these are question-begging. This is sort of an irrational bias towards the East. The fact that it has to use these forgeries and used them quite often at the time. And so the origin of rationalism based in this kind of manipulation, well, so much is explained then in the Western mind much later on. The uncritical attitude towards facts and arguments, to one degree or another, virtually all religious and philosophical, ideological, political movements, doctrines, sects, parties, whatever it is, in the Western Europe right up to the present day. Now, there was a time when the West ceased to claim this. There were many forgeries used. The left, the regime, also uses forgeries and make-believe all the time. I'm not saying there's a direct connection here, obviously, but the political hegemony of the West was justified in the allegedly exclusive religious and secular leadership of the papacy. A lot of this then eventually led to the Protestant Revolution. Now, the Protestant Revolution, regardless of the abuses of Rome, what happened in Northern Europe had no connection to any of this. E. Michael Jones has proven very well that there were a lot of priests who wanted to get married. They were using a lot of, you know, very wealthy oligarchs who loved to take the monastic lands and start their first real estate market, and that's exactly what they did. Ultimately coming down to the basing of legitimacy on democracy, since it was quite individualistic at first. Of course, the problem with Protestantism always will be that not everyone should be reading the Bible, and when they do, even people who should be are often taking whatever they want from it. An authority is absolutely necessary. You know, Protestantism is self-destructing. It's a disease. It is to government what anarchy is to it is to religion what anarchy is to government. So there's a next phase. We're talking about now nominalism, the Enlightenment, the separation of science from religion. Now, Vasily Zenkovsky says that, and this is of course our writer is talking about this. This separation was formalized in the works of Thomas Aquinas. Now, I've read Thomas Aquinas until I wanted to blow my brains out. That was many years ago. Placing religion and science in different compartments, I don't recall that. That's an exaggeration, they know that, but I don't recall that at all. But it certainly was very analytic in the sense that it was very rationalistic. I don't think that they believed that reason was purely autonomous. That didn't come until René Descartes. But this is what Vasily Zenkovsky had to say about it. This teaching on the self-sufficiency of natural reason and understanding the world and man is essentially a new concept, alien to the main currents, even to ancient thought. Elevating revelation above natural reason, Aquinas at the same time dissects the unified integrity of the cognitive process. With his decision, he set out on a new path. It is from Thomas that we must face the break between Christianity and culture. The entire tragic meaning of which one has now been revealed with full force. Now, it is true. I remember the very first week, many years ago, I read the natural law doctrines of Aquinas. And I wasn't sure I was in the right section. And when I say that, I mean it was about words and formalities. It had nothing to do with the actual content of natural law. You know, pursuing the good and eschewing evil, well, that begs the question, but I can't believe that was even something that had to be said. I guess that was kind of a foundation. This is what Andrew Skeptic, actually this is in a footnote that he has in his great book, but it should be in full. He says, beginning in the 13th century, the separation of various spheres of culture from the church, from spiritual orientation, began in the West. This first manifested itself in the area of law. And then in the 14th, 15th centuries, this movement began to spread with extraordinary speed over all spheres of culture, anthropology, philosophy, and science. Over the course of two or three centuries, a profound change occurred in the psychology of cultural creativity, which gave rise to a free but already secular style of culture, mentality. This departure of culture from the church had many different roots, general development in church history, in Western history. But once it began, it led and continues to lead in its separation from the church. The religious tragedy was fixed by this for a long time. and all modern history in the West has proceeded and continues to proceed under the sign of a fundamental dualism: Christianity in life, Christianity in culture, Christianity in labor, in two different compartments. Well, then they get to the third aspect of this, which is René Descartes, which is, you know, I think, where it started. They don't say anything about William of Ockham. He doesn't say anything about William of Ockham. He's easy to overlook. He's not an easy guy to read. He's very eccentric. But René Descartes, you know, was at least somewhat approachable. But Descartes didn't die until 1650. This is one fundamental element. He says, this is Descartes speaking here, nothing characterizes. No, I'm sorry, this isn't Descartes speaking. This is Andrew Skevich speaking. But he's talking about Descartes in that whole era. Nothing characterizes the new attitude of creative consciousness with such force as the fact that doubt is now placed at the basis of philosophy. It was proclaimed by Descartes as the main method and rule of philosophical minds. Doubt, of course, can and should have its place in the process of reflection. But are there really no direct sources of philosophy? Doubt in general is, after all, a secondary function of the mind, but it's always directed to some positive assertions. In other words, doubt is a very weak place to start. Now, you know, yes, St. Augustine did the same thing, but it was in a very specific area. He didn't base his philosophy on it. Augustine was defending reason. Come up with a proposition that no one could deny. And if they denied it, they're contradicting themselves. And that's what he came up with. Very similar. But it was not the center of his philosophy. It was to answer a question. That was culminating into Immanuel Kant, of course, who died in 1804. Ortega Gasset, great Spanish philosopher, says that it's Kant who brought the revolution in Western philosophy and the ideologies of the West that followed from it. Similar to the revolution, the cliché is that it's a Copernican revolution. I hate using clichés, but that's what Kant himself used, actually, talking about the previous astrophysical concepts of Western Europe, allegedly concerning the geocentric Western concepts, ignoring the ideas on this issue that existed in the ancient world and in the Orthodox East. So Ortega, who was trying to deal with this, I'm a big fan of Ortega. You know, Ortega wrote a lot more than just Revolt of the Masses. In his Kant, Hegel, Delphi, he said this. I think it's very profound. Man of the ancient world proceeds from a feeling of trust in the world, which for him is, first of all, the cosmos, order. Modern man proceeds from distrust, from suspicion. From the world for him is chaos, disorder. Descartes and Kant, the two highest figures of modern philosophy, raise their anchor with the same mind of suspicion. The system of Kant and his followers remained in the history of philosophy under the name of idealism with colossal courage and persistence. The white man of the West has explored the world during the last four centuries from a purely idealistic point of view. He fulfilled his mission to the end, trying out all the possibilities that were contained in it. And he reached the end. He discovered that this was a mistake. The feeling of cosmic fear led to the fact that, beginning with Kant, German philosophy ceased to be a philosophy of being and turned into a philosophy of culture. Knowledge ceases to be a passive mirror image of reality, and it becomes a construction. What is vulgarly called reality becomes just raw material, chaotic, without any meaning, which can be sculpted. I do not think that all of human history there has ever been a more daring revolution than this. Kant himself calls it his Copernican revolution. In fact, Copernicus limits himself to replacing one reality with another. Kant, on the other hand, turns the entire reality upside down. He throws off the mask of master and proclaims dictatorship. Ortega wrote that in 1961 in Madrid. Now, whether the theories of Werner Heisenberg have overthrown that, whether quantum mechanics have overthrown that, is a separate issue. But I should mention it. because Andrew Skevitz mentions it. And maybe I should, maybe, you know, it won't take too much time, but Heisenberg says, if we compare Kant's doctrines with modern physics today, we shall have the impression that from the very beginning, his fundamental conception of the synthetic judgments a priori have been completely destroyed by the discoveries of our century. The theory of probability has changed the ideas we had of space and time. In fact, it has shown us an entirely new vision of space and time, which are not all visible in the a priori forms of Kant's pure intuition. The law of causality no longer applies in quantum theory. And the law of conservation of matter has ceased to be true with respect to elementary particles anyway. It is obvious that Kant could not foresee the new discoveries, since he was convinced that his conceptions would be the foundations of any future metaphysics that could ever be called science. It would be interesting to know where the error in his argument lay. The great difficulties in understanding and perceiving the concepts of modern physics have their roots in Descartes' vision of the cosmos into res cogitans and res extensia, thinking thing and extended thing, thinking and being. This division has penetrated deeply, and over the course of three centuries into the human mind, it will take a long time to replace it with a truly different position in relation to reality. That's straight out of Werner Heisenberg, Physics and Philosophy, translated in numerous, you know, Spanish, Russian, English, whatever. And that was in 1959. Now, it would be an exaggeration to say that Kant said that we ignore reality because reality is unknowable. The only thing that's beyond any doubt is what is in consciousness and our thinking. Now, that's not an exaggeration. Moreover, this reality must, one way or another, be adjusted to our mental schemes in order to improve it. Moreover, in practice, violence is even allowed for this. As Lenin said, if facts are against us, then so much the worse for the facts. I think that's a forced conclusion that our author here is coming to. That Andrew Skevitz is coming through. But I understand where he is, where he's coming from. The point of all of this, that the problem highlights the contradiction in Western rationalism. I mean, if Western rationalism is the omnipotence of the human mind, or of mind, what happened to the proclamation of its autonomy in relation to reality lying outside of man, or outside of his mind? Then it turns out that all schematic constructions of his mind do not need experimental verification. The macro-ideology of the West renounces its previous postulate on the necessity of experimentation in the field of scientific research. And we know that's true. If reality is, in fact, basically unknowable for the human mind, then in this case, it's also essentially changeable at the whim of the mind as well. This is another way of saying that the most powerful people can make those changes. Such isolation and mutual alienation between reason and reality has been refuted by science today. If you take Heisenberg's work seriously, if the, you know, subatomic particles matter, but Ortega-Gasset also believed the previous successes and progress of Western civilization were at one time due to this very tendency, this desire for experimentation, in addition to its predisposition for analysis. However, if idealism is true, and reality is distant, or maybe unknowable, you know, the Ding An Sich, if this is unknowable, this is what Ortega will call sculptures, subject to reckless reforms, then the autonomous evolution of reality is denied. Development of reality is replaced, on the one hand, by forcibly introduced revolution, and on the other hand, by the petrification of the same revolution, while stubbornly ignoring the experimental results of such manipulations, and even no last-minute perestroikas will be able to prevent catastrophe. Forcing objective reality in the Procrustean bed of subjective schemes is irrational and inevitably leads to catastrophe. Well, the obsession with dogmatism, especially from our enemies, we're not entirely free of it. But our enemy, certainly, it doesn't matter, you know, what IQs mean, crime statistics mean, they're right. and they'll send you to prison. We could show you all the Jews who ran the Soviet Union that were responsible for the slaughtering of millions of people. It doesn't matter. Truth is secondary. In other words, experimentation is now out of the question. So its ideologies are now beyond, are simply indisputable truth. They're beyond any need for verification. So Darwinism, Freudianism, even socialism to some extent. So this kind of rationalism ignores the contradictions in its approach to the individual social sciences. So, you know, if you're an anthropologist, you have to be committed to the theory of evolutionism. That you have no choice. Even when you start talking about DNA, you know, of course, it can explain DNA. It can explain irreducible clusters. There's a lot it can explain. But it doesn't matter. As a result, though, postmodernism, Western culture, the maximum abstractions of artificial, schematic, and virtual constructions from any real reality has been achieved. And they're all dead ends, of course. Even to the point of economics, these virtual financial instruments, economic reality, are indicative, like derivatives, betting on securities that no one really knows about. The better doesn't even own them. No one owns them. The investors have no idea what they are. It's assumed that they're there. So even there, you have this concern. Ideology is more important than reality. So truth and righteousness, well, that's out of the question. The left, the regime, surrounds itself with censorship and speech codes and armies, if necessary. You go to prison for bringing a lot of this stuff up, especially with the unmentionables in the EU. Truth is a correspondence of reason with reality. Well, it certainly is not in the decaying postmodern world. Now, the other thing that Andrew Skevich was very interested in was Oswald Spengler and what he meant relative to the decline of Western civilizations or the North Atlantic ideology. We have to be very careful again. Western civilization is such the term is so huge as to be useless. We really mean Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment elites or oligarchs. Oswald Spengler, who died in 1936, The Decline of the West, I think the first volume was 1918 and the second in 1923. Even with this book itself, as often happens in postmodernity, instead of rational arguments on the merits against this or that idea, you use propaganda to destroy people. The Decline of the West was caused, for example, by Germany's defeat in the First World War in 1918, because it came out right after it. But Spengler himself said, no, this has been written over the course of a decade, starting in 1908. But it doesn't matter. These simplistic slogans are far more important. You know, the Holocaust, you know, Hitler was at the start of World War II, all this nonsense. All for no reason, of course. Well, it's been 100 years. More than 100 years, and everything's changed. Things have gotten far worse. Now, Spengler predicted that roughly by the year 2000, Western civilization would start to fall apart. And it would lead to maybe a century or two of Caesarism. Somehow this extra-constitutional omnipotence of the executive branch of government. That comes out of James Holton's Einstein History and Other Passions, Rebellion Against Science at the End of the 20th Century. The concept that we've spoken of so many times here, the regime, is not discussed because that wasn't, I'm sure that was even conceivable at the time. But Spengler introduced many concepts that we're still using all the time. Apollonian cultures and civilizations usually refer to Greece and Rome. The appreciation for the beauty of the human body, the preference for local in the present moment. The Apollonian is ahistorical. You know, Spengler said the classical world didn't feel the same anxiety as a Faustian would when confronted with a strange event. The Magian culture and civilization would include the Israelites from maybe 400 BC. And he includes some early Christians and various Arabian religions, up until including Islam. Now, of course, we have problems with this, but he described it as having a world feeling that revolved around the world as a cavern, the dome mosque, the preoccupation with essence. Spengler saw the development of this culture as being distorted by the too influential presence of older civilizations, the initial vigorous expansionary impulses of Islam being a part reaction to this. The Faustian, of course I have several papers on this, began in Western Europe as early as the 10th century. Had such expansionary power that by the 20th century it covered the whole earth, with only a few exceptions to this. The world feeling, a concept of infinity, infinitely wide and profound space. It's yearning towards distance and infinity, like all the fairy tales about what the space is like. Trillions and trillions of galaxies, and all this dogma. But the term Faustian, of course, is comes out of the Goethe's play of Faust. And Johann Goethe had a massive effect on Spengler. And it comes down to the dissatisfied intellectual willing to make a pact with the devil in return for unlimited knowledge. Spengler believed that that more than anything represented the Western Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment elite's thirst for power. Not necessarily thirst for knowledge, but thirst for power. This confrontation with the infinite, as he called it. Now, concerning Russia, Spengler saw something very strange, and I think he's right to say it. He has the concept of a pseudomorphosis. Pseudomorphosis is something that Spengler borrows from geology, really. It's a way of explaining a semi-developed or only partially developed culture. It's when an older culture or civilization is so deeply ingrained within the younger one that it can't find its own or full expression. So in other words, the young soul, as he put it, is cast into old modes. There's always a sense of inferiority. So in Russia, Spengler saw this, and it occurred in the Petrian Revolution. Peter the Great distorted the Tsarism of Russia to the dynastic form of Western Europe. The burning of Moscow, as Napoleon was set to invade, he described as the primitive expression of hatred towards the foreigner. In the following entry of Alexander I into Paris, the Holy Alliance, the concert of Europe, said that Russia was forced into an artificial history before its culture was ready to incapable of understanding its burden. This would result in the hatred towards Europe, which Spengler said poisoned the womb of an emerging new culture in Russia. So he doesn't name it. But he said that Tolstoy is the past and Dostoevsky is the future. I mentioned Toynbee in his 10-volume study of history, which, believe it or not, I've read many years ago. Of course, study of history is civilizations, large societies. And he had 19 of them, or 21, depending. You know, the Western, Eastern Orthodox, Islam, Indian, Far Eastern. The rest are kind of, you know, non-existing. The list is far more realistic than others. But he's the first one to actually list the Eastern Orthodox, or Byzantine-Russian, and defines that as a twin of Western civilization, since both of them come from the Hellenic, the ancient Greek civilization. So to confirm his generalization, he even says, like, you know, in the case of some other civilizations, following Spengler, he believes that the chronological run of each civilization is predetermined. Now, I think what Toynbee said is absolutely an exaggeration. However, Spengler was absolutely right in talking about the Petrian Revolution as forcing Russia into a role that it was never supposed to be in. And the revolution of Patriarch Nikon, same way. The whole concept of the pseudomorphosis is important because civilizations, of which there is a few nations within it, are separated. They're separate, and they should be. Here's what Andruskiewicz says, and I like this. The central axis of any state ideology is its moral unifying idea. As Dostoevsky expressed it, at the beginning of any people, any nationality, the moral idea always preceded the birth of nationality, for it was that it created it. The moral idea always came from the mystical, that is, religious ideas. This means that this is a moral, mystical, religious, central, fundamental, basic idea, which is like a core, an axis around which all the others develop of a given nationality, and they're grouped around it. And by the way, Aristotle also claimed, about 24 centuries before Dostoevsky, political science began with Plato and Aristotle. Aristotle said that the state is based on law, on written law, but he says that even before the appearance of written law, there's an unwritten law, developed by the people themselves. We call them everyday law, mores, ethos. That's where ethics come from. Before his work, Politics, Aristotle places his work on ethics. We're talking about mores. From this comes the concept of morality in Russian, Sittlichkeit in German. But if that's not developed, as we've said before, there'll be no normal state. There will be an anti-state, which will be based on anti-ethics, anti-morality, and anti-religion. In other words, we come back to the beginning. All historically significant civilizations, within which a few nations exist within, have their own distinctive, specific characteristics. And of course, for the Western, it is rationalism. You can call it humanism, that reason is somehow autonomous. Certainly not connected to anything like our bodies or any culture or any civilization. The West, of course, now is an anti-civilization. Again, Toynbee says that they came from the same root, therefore they're twin sisters, but the revolution has gone so far beyond, you know, Toynbee's been dead a long time. I don't think they would even recognize it today. Rationalism is not inherent to any civilization. It's almost a chimera. And it's certainly not found this way in the Eastern world. So then he asks two questions. Andruskiewicz asks two questions. And it's the same two questions that I've asked at the beginning. What's the difference in attitude towards rationalism? What place does it occupy? And how did this divergence occur? We're right back to the beginning again. And how does this lead ultimately to Faustianism? Let me quote it here, right from Goethe's play. This is Faustus speaking. But I am indifferent to the afterlife. At the hour when this world is destroyed, for him, I will have no kinship with that world. I am a son of the earth. Joys and sorrows I experience on it alone. At the bitter hour when I leave it, I don't care if the grass doesn't grow. I don't care about the other world. Whatever the feelings that are called, I'm not curious where its boundaries are and whether there's an up or a down there in that further kingdom. I mean, Mephistopheles says, so much the easier it will be, with that point of view, for you to enter an agreement with me. For this, rely on my vow, I will give you what the world has never seen. So the Faustian West is even a decline of modernism. It's breaking us into postmodernity. Remember, Spengler's book was published in Russia right away. It had a huge influence. Simon Frank, Berdyaev, Stepun, many others made reference to it. The Eurasianists spoke about it all the time. They spoke about it especially with overcoming the westernizing St. Petersburg period, which itself led to revolution. Revolutionary fall is temporary, as Spengler seemed to suggest. But what about from the Orthodox point of view? The Orthodox point of view, all the mentioned classifications, I've been through this many times before, history and civilizations, whether it be Danilevsky, Spengler, Schubart, Toynbee, this listing of the various civilizations, even Samuel Huntington, 30 years ago, had about 25 years ago, had a listing of civilizations in his work. It still implies naturalism. It still implies something has to go beyond it. There's another criterion revealed to us in Scripture itself, and that is the abuse of the freedom granted to mankind under the influence of Satan, which ultimately led to the Judaization of the world. In other words, the mystery of lawlessness, with the goal of building the kingdom of the Antichrist. Therefore, now it's wonderful we have positive assessments of the Russian Orthodox culture by non-Orthodox authors. They're general and vague, but it seems that the restraining mission of the Third Rome is totally outside of their field of vision. So what does Orthodox history have to say about it? We don't really need to classify civilizations this way. All events, from the fall of Adam, the saving coming of Christ, and further, as a result of the fall of the chosen people, of the Jews who chose the devil as their father, to a new abuse of freedom, and ultimately the reign of the Antichrist and the victory of Christ over him in the second coming. All of that represents a consistent logical chain of stages of the struggle between Satan and God for the fate of humanity. Free in his choice. Man makes free choices within it. All nations, all the civilizations mentioned above, they fit within this general system of coordinates. The main drama of history takes place, and that civilization, the Israelite, of course, then the Christian and the Orthodox, is given the knowledge of God's truth, in which Satan seeks to distort with heresies and replace it with atheism. But atheism is only a transitional stage to Satanism. In the Christian era, in Europe, those heresies are Gnostic heresies, the Catholic schism, the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, the Masonic revolutions, the destruction of the remaining Third Rome, Marxist, Leninist, satanic rehearsal of the apocalypse in Russia, and of course, what happened in the 1990s. Truly doesn't have a name. Almost philosophy, the essence of this process consists in a departure from God and an atheistic deification of man, or at least some men, which in reality was only a game of Satan on human pride. And of course, the Jews were at the center of it. Now we're at this apocalyptic era, the construction of the kingdom of Antichrist on the basis of Western, technologically powerful, Judaized post-Christian civilization, way post-Christian civilization. So it's not really appropriate to speak of the decline of Faustian civilization, but of its earthly material triumph in alliance with Satan, which will end the civilization as bad as it ended for Faustus. It won't be a decline. It'll be a collapse, and we're living it right now. The construction of the Jewish New World Order, and now the Great Reset and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, does not seem that any other constituent elements of the modern Western culture could ever change any of this. All other peoples, the Third World, Muslims, passively oppose it. China certainly is opposing it. Quite ready to play the role of Gog and Magog for Antichrist, for the Protestants, if they would like it. But they have a role to play too. But the Third Rome, that restrained evil, no longer exists, and there will not be a fourth. In the 1990s, a new ruling class took over, blatantly Jewish, criminal, under Yeltsin and Gaidar. But even today, there are circles that just can't learn the lesson of the revolution. Spiritually illiterate politicians, traitors to Russia, are striving to become the appendage of the West, occupying a niche in it as just a raw materials colony provider. Even the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate, and its social doctrine is ecumenical. It wants its little niche in the Jewish kingdom of Antichrist, in union not only with Catholics, but with the Jews. As so many have said, patriarchs have said, your prophets are our prophets, and all this nonsense. And if you were to say that to the Jews today, your prophets are our prophets, you don't know anything about Judaism whatsoever. But it's very hard to talk to these people about it. They immediately respond with anger and contempt. We've spoken about that already. But somehow, ideology, and no, we haven't mentioned William of Ockham and Drukavich fails to mention him, and it's a mistake. But, you know, I'm one of the first to really bring him out in this. It's one of the things that I've, you know, brought to the table here. That and, you know, oligarchy as a actual system, an institution of political economy. Markets don't work anymore. Oligarchs don't serve markets, they create them. They don't have to listen to anybody. The market doesn't explain anything as to what's happening now. Certainly doesn't explain things like derivatives or putting all these black people in movies and knowing that they're losing a fortune. Oligarchy means a lot more than just profits. Oligarchy ultimately comes down to, as I've said, the socializing of costs and the privatizing of profits. Keep the profits for yourself, but any bad things that we do, we just spread it within the society and let others pay for it. That's how you succeed. That's what postmodern capitalism is. It has nothing to do with markets. It's who can pull that off the best. But remember, Andruskevich was a royalist. He was a monarchist. He was a strict Russian Orthodox man. And he fancied himself a political theorist. But just as importantly, he talks about subordinost. What we can, you know, what the Westerners would call conciliarity, but it means a lot more than that. The Sobornos system is broader and deeper than any monarch. Now I'm quoting Andruskevich directly here. Moreover, it was the foundation and support in Old Rus. When this conciliar system replenished from the combined popular elected authorities, the symphonic participation of the church ceased to function after Peter the Great, the Tsarist power burdened itself excessively with all state functions simultaneously weakening itself excessively, so it no longer had the support of the Patriarch, the Zemensky Sobor, or the Duma. On the contrary, the conciliar system, even without a monarch, was able, in the case of 1611, 1613, and was the case for quite a time afterwards with the Cossacks, ultimately always organically sought to supplement the crown with a true royal leadership. A truncated monarchy, deprived of any conciliar structure, of any elected structure at the local level, is doomed to perish, despite the personal merits of the monarchs themselves. The first step in the destruction of our monarchy, the Russian monarchy, the destruction of the conciliar system, that is to say, this period of time between Nikon and the middle of the 18th century. Now, I don't like it when Andruskevich, he tends to romanticize Novgorod. He tends to take the paper reality for actual reality. The Veshche was certainly not representative of anyone except the very elite. It was very small. The best people there meant the wealthiest ones. The prince was their subject. It was very much like it was in Poland. Crowned the entire structure. So he suggests that the mixed popular, aristocratic, and royalist system was apparently inherent in all Slavs in general. As evidenced by the political system in some cities of the southern Slavs, like Novgorod, city of Kotor on the Adriatic coast, where the Supreme Council will call by small and great Vesha, the ringing of bells. Well, Kotor too, of course being a port city, was highly oligarchic. But I think I understand what he means. I don't like his examples. But of course, without a bureaucracy, you needed the conciliar idea, the dumas at the local level, the royal, loyal, but very, you know, monarchist, noble families. That's what, you know, that's why they didn't need a bureaucracy. That's why they didn't need a prison system. Russia didn't develop a prison system until the very end of the 19th century. He likes the Novgorod idea, at least on paper. But let me quote him again. Andruskevich says, in this regard, in the modern political consciousness of the broad masses, who consider elective power to be the only legitimate one, the concept of legitimacy was passed by. This is a complex topic, both in meaning and in its perception at different times. But here we cannot help but point to the theory of the Spanish philosopher Ortega about monarchy as the only full-fledged manifestation of legitimacy in political life. So then, Ortega, he says, the state doesn't consist of legitimacy as an abstraction, just a happy addition. Peoples manage to provide their state for this virtue only in their best times. That's an abstraction. You can't really base it. You know, it's like saying state should be based on virtue. Ortega says the original prototypical legitimacy, the only dense, saturated one, was among almost all known peoples. The king, by the grace of God, in his pure form, there was no other legitimacy. Legitimacy of the elective power is incomplete. It's secondary. Now, Ortega argued that legitimacy is an idea primarily of religious origin, because the people can't have any other idea than a religious or mystic figure. We see it today with the mystification of the presidency as almost a god. He's responsible for everything in the world. Prices go up, it must be the president's fault. That's a perversion of it, but it still shows that there's something deep in the human psyche. But still, the ancient figure of the king is sacred. He's not a chief, a leader, or anything else by chance. It's because he has a right to be so. Therefore, he must stand outside the routine. He must either be called or otherwise singled out, anointed. He can't be seeking power himself. The difference between complete and incomplete legitimacy is that the bearer of complete legitimate power must be called to it and not strive for it himself. I see that with Bashar al-Assad, who did not want power. He was called to it, and he ruled justly as a result. Metropolitan Anastasi. He talks about the revolutionary formula, freedom, equality, and brotherhood, borrowed from, in part from the gospel, lacks the fourth member, that of love, as Solzhenitsyn says. Only love could crown like a dome this triad. Without what lacks internal unity, fertilize these very principles, giving them an active living force. The minute you attach that freedom, equality, and brotherhood to atheism, it becomes sickening. But logos changes it entirely. Love requires religious faith or religious knowledge. The correct relationship between the correct authorities can only be achieved by the same correct orthodox faith, the basis of all human relations and socio-political ideas. I don't like the idea the scholastics had this contempt for actual content. The Christian faith must be enculturated. Russian Orthodox Church is Russian. It is Russian culture. It's the core of Russian culture. There's no Russian culture without it. And that's where I'm going to end. Igor Andruskevich, he deserves to be read. I don't know if anything of his is in English. But I gave you the best I could, a thumbnail sketch of his point of view, using all the authorities that he enjoyed using. And he was a good man. And he died in the grace of God. And I hope we all do the same. Thank you very much for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.